I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour is a slight variation on a much-requested listener request for our show. The policy cloud of the 50 U.S. states, our guest this hour writes, has grown in recent years. States playing key roles in voting rights, health reform, labor laws, and climate regulations to promote coordinated agendas in state houses. Conservatives can leverage long-standing, well-funded networks, while liberals started later and have made only fitful progress at building their own policy networks. We're going to be talking about particular emphasis on the conservative groups and how they have had a great deal of success in taking on unions, certainly. They've also looked at other issues that have been of great importance, cutting and privatizing public services, and also lowering taxes, removing regulations, and other issues that are of concern to many of these conservative organizations. Our guest this hour will tell us who these organizations are, when they got formed, and why liberal groups are not as numerous and prominent or successful in getting their legislative agendas passed as conservative groups are. Should be a very interesting hour. And as our guest, we have Alex Hertel Fernandez. He's a doctoral candidate in government and social policy at Harvard University. He studies the political economy of the United States with an emphasis on the politics of organized interests, especially business and public policy. His research has been published in the Journal of Health Politics, Policy and Law, Perspectives on Politics, Studies in American Political Development, and the Social Service Review. And he is our guest this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook, the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Alex, thank you very much for a much-requested program. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking with you and hearing from your listeners.
Yeah, so am I. It should be a very good hour. It is amazing, and we're looking at a state where ALEC has been very strong and where we have Republican control of all levels of government. And so the agenda, Republican agenda, has really changed this state rather dramatically. These organizations, if you have one-party control, have an incredible amount of clout, don't they?
Absolutely. And I think the power of a lot of these conservative networks was really cast in stark relief, especially after the legislative elections in 2010 and 2014 that saw Republicans taking over record numbers of state houses and governorships. But I think it's important to emphasize, as you did in your summary of the show, that these organizations have been around for a really long time. You know, in the case of ALEC, it was created in the 1970s. So while they're having new success in this era of Republican control of many state governments, they've been having success for many years since the 1970s in the case of ALEC.
Mm-hmm. And let's look at what the conservative organizations are. How many of them are there, and a breakdown of what their responsibilities are? Is ALEC the largest and most successful?
I would say that there are three main organizations that operate on the conservative side of the political spectrum to shape elections and public policy. And these are the groups that I'm focusing in my research. So, yes, you have ALEC on the one hand that coordinates with state lawmakers. Those are the key members and brings them together with private sector companies and other conservative groups. And they promote model bill ideas that they then distribute to their lawmaker members and encourage them to introduce, often wholesale, in state lawmakers' legislative assemblies. But ALEC isn't operating on its own. There's the State Policy Network as well. That's an organization that brings together conservative free market think tanks with at least one in every state. And these are organizations that focus their energies on state politics rather than national politics. And what you often see are State Policy Network affiliates coming up with research reports, testimony, and even media coverage that's supportive of the proposals that ALEC is putting forward. And then the most recent addition to the conservative landscapes is an organization called Americans for Prosperity that was created in the mid-2000s, in 2004, by the Koch Political Network. And they leverage a whole slew of grassroots activists. They count over 2 million Americans as activists on their rolls, and they can organize rallies, stage protests right into the state legislatures to support the sort of bills that ALEC is coming up with and that the State Policy Network is also supporting. So these three different organizations work together. In a recent piece, Sita Skocpol and I described them as the conservative triple threat, given that they operate in such close coordination with one another.
Do they have the most money?
So I think money is an important part of the reason why conservatives have been more successful than liberals in operating across the states. But it isn't the whole story. I think there is a considerable amount of wealth on the left that could be invested in these kinds of activities. In recent years, you've seen the growth of the tech sector out in California and finance. And there are a lot of wealthy liberal millionaires and some even billionaires as well that could be investing in these kinds of activities. But what you've seen is that center-left foundations and wealthy liberal folks have been reluctant almost to invest in the states in the same way as conservatives, and that's been a key obstacle.
And tell me about this model legislation. We've certainly seen this in the state of Wisconsin, the model legislation that ALEC has put together that really we have seen circulated and passed in many instances in many states in the country. What are they interested
in? Yeah, so this is a key strategy that ALEC uses, which is to come up with policy ideas. And of course, that's something that all interest groups do to some extent or another. But ALEC takes it a step further and crafts model bill language that is kind of exactly what you need to introduce in a legislative body to bring about a policy change. And that makes it very easy for you as a lawmaker to take one of ALEC's ideas, simply cut out the header and the footer, insert your state's name in the appropriate places, and just introduce that as your own bill in your legislative assembly. And in fact, we've seen that all over the country. And in some cases, actually, lawmakers have forgotten to take off the header and the footer.
Really?
In Minnesota a few years ago, there were a couple ALEC model bills that still had the ALEC model bill at the top of it that were introduced. So sometimes lawmakers get a little lazy.
And who?
But I think it's an...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering, who is writing those bills?
Yeah, so the people writing the ALEC model bills are a combination of the private sector companies that come to ALEC's meetings, especially in the 90s and the early 2000s, a number of high-profile companies that you and your listeners might be familiar with, from Visa to Amazon to McDonald's to pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical trade associations, were crafting ALEC model bills that had to do with the sort of things that their companies were interested in. So if you were a pharmaceutical company, regulations on the sale of pharmaceutical products or intellectual property rights. If you were, say, a tobacco company, legislation that would alleviate tobacco regulations and so on and so forth. So companies are a major source of the policy ideas for ALEC, but so too are conservative activists as well. And that's actually been a tension within ALEC over time, because sometimes the conservatives push legislation that companies haven't been too thrilled with. I think a great example of this is the Stand Your Ground model bill that ALEC was promoting for many years that attracted a lot of attention in the wake of that controversy in Florida when a teenager was shot, and it was revealed that his defense was in part resting on the Stand Your Ground law in Florida that permits the use of gun violence for self-defense, and ALEC was promoting that bill. That's something that many mainstream companies were a little bit uncomfortable with, and I think that's why you saw many companies distancing themselves from ALEC after that connection came to light. So that relationship between companies and conservatives is sometimes a rocky one.
Do you think that most people are aware that the companies, in some cases, are writing these pieces of legislation instead of the people that we elected to be our legislators?
You know, I think there's an increasing awareness of the lobbying activities of ALEC, thanks to some great journalism work that's been done, as well as a nonprofit in your state, the Center for Media and Democracy, released a whole bunch of these model bills in 2010 and then in 2012 as well. And I think that helped people realize that a lot of these bills were being introduced by lawmakers, and lawmakers weren't saying where they got that idea from. You know, of course, lawmakers can rely on whatever resources they want to craft legislation, but I think it's important for citizens to know where those policy ideas were coming from and who benefits from those policy ideas. You know, if a bill is going to line the pockets of a particular company, I think citizens and constituents have a right to know about that.
Right. Now, on the left, in fits and starts, you write, liberal activists, academics, and D.C. policy organizations have used intermittent and modest funding from foundations and labor unions to build left-leaning policy networks. What are they, and why aren't they as effective as the conservative groups?
Yeah, I think the key word there is intermittent. So there have been various efforts over the years, starting in the 1970s, to construct a sort of liberal equivalent to ALEC. But what you've seen is these initiatives have either run out of money or they haven't had a lot of success breaking out of the traditional liberal enclaves, places like Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I am, San Francisco, Los Angeles. You tend to see organizations on the left that are centered in those sorts of places, and less in the middle of the country where there are important policy debates happening. And I think part of the problem is funding, as we mentioned, but part of the problem is locating efforts across the country, not just in places where liberals are focused. And then also playing for the rules. This is something that conservatives have been quite effective at, I think. And you alluded to this when you were talking about changes to union rules and voting rules. I think conservative networks like ALEC, the State Policy Network, and Americans for Prosperity have done a great job of thinking about policy as a way of advancing their political agenda. If you change voting rules in a way that make it harder for your opponents to vote, that's a victory for your side. If you change rules to make it harder for unions to organize, that's a victory for conservatives, because unions are an important ally of the left. And I think liberals have not done as good of a job at thinking about policy in that way.
Go back to 1975 for a moment. Why did we see any of these groups start to form in those years? Do you know?
Yeah, so on the right, you saw ALEC emerge as a response to a fear, actually, amongst conservatives that liberals were gaining strength in the state. So as happens so frequently in American politics, one side looks to the other and gets scared and copies them, and then you see another response right back. So conservatives looked at public sector labor unions, which in many states had just gotten the right to organize. You know, these are unions of teachers and other public professionals. And they said, look, you know, these are organized interest groups that could promote liberal policy across the states. We need to get our act together to do something similar. And so that's why you saw the rise of ALEC and later the State Policy Network.
And so for liberal groups to have the same kind of clout that conservative groups, liberal groups need to copy some of the playbook of the conservative groups?
I think, you know, you can't make a carbon copy of what's happened on the right, on the left. You know, there are just differences in both the ideology and the resources that are available to liberals. But I think there are some lessons that liberals could learn. For instance, making membership meaningful. The one thing that I think ALEC has done quite well is that it makes membership attractive to ordinary lawmakers, especially lawmakers in states where you don't get paid a lot or you don't have many staffers or resources. This has been a key strength of ALEC. You know, if you're a part-time lawmaker, you need some help drafting your legislation. And if you're not getting it from the staffers, you may not have any staffers at all, then ALEC presents itself as an attractive alternative. They give you the resources you need to make policy, and they invite you to a couple posh meetings a year where you get to hobnob with, you know, corporate elites and have nice meals, stay in a fancy hotel. Those things are important. They bring together a network of lawmakers from across the country. And I think liberal organizations need to take that kind of network more seriously. Now, I should mention that there is a new effort that was launched in 2014 called the State Innovation Exchange. It's kind of the latest liberal effort to counter ALEC's strength in the states. And so I think it will be interesting to see what they learn and what they take from Alec's success in the coming years. It's too soon to see whether or not they've been successful, but I think it's an important organization to watch.
Isn't there also, or should there be, a conversation asking whether or not these should exist? It seems to be a kind of a twisting of democracy, isn't it?
I think that's a question that everyone and each individual citizen needs to think about and come up with an answer on their own. From my perspective, as a government, we've always had interest groups to some extent that are lobbying government and are pressing their demands on lawmakers. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think what becomes more problematic is when you only have organizations on one side of the spectrum or organizations that are only representing one kind of interest. And I think that's what's concerning about the state landscape right now is that the best organized groups are those that are representing corporate and conservative interests, and that there isn't so much representation of the other side of the political spectrum.
Let's go to phone calls. I know we're going to have many for you, Alex. Alex Hertel Fernandez is our guest this hour, and he's done a very interesting study on how conservative groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Americans for Prosperity, how they're organized, how they operate, how they are helping legislators in many states that tend to be conservative-leaning, writing legislation. It's cookie-cutter kind of legislation in many instances, so you'll see the same bill appear in lots of different states written by ALEC. The liberal counterparts to these organizations and why they are not as effective. Here's our phone number. I can guarantee you on this issue our lines are going to be crowded. So call now if you want to get through this. One line open. The number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. And we'll be with you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Alex. We start our calls with Bob in Wisconsin, Oregon, Wisconsin. Hi, Bob.
Hi. So I get and understand everything your guest is talking about, but I guess, in my opinion, it makes little to no difference where these ideas are coming from if one branch or the other, or one party or the other, has control, or in the case of Wisconsin, absolute control over the legislature. I mean, they're going to get their agenda out there and not even allow anything from the opposition to be brought to a vote.
Alex.
Yeah, Bob, thanks so much for that point, Bob. I think you're exactly right that in this area of polarized politics, whoever controls the state house can really promote their agenda. But I think it's an important question to ask who has been helping to elect these sorts of lawmakers, and there you see Americans for Prosperity playing a big role in helping to ensure these conservative and Republican victories that you've seen in the last legislative elections. And, of course, I think it does matter where the ideas for these lawmakers come from, because you could see a very different agenda if, say, ALEC didn't exist and wasn't promoting its model bills across the states.
Thank you, Bob, so much for your call. We go to Lee in Shell Lake next. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to say that I don't believe it's just a lack of organization that's screwing over the liberals. I used to be a liberal and a Democrat for many years, but I believe that they've mostly abandoned wage-earning Americans, and I could list a half a dozen important examples of that. And so that's my only point, that I think the liberals just basically have abandoned us. And so I probably won't even vote for Miss Piggy this year.
You're not going to vote in the election?
Probably not.
Do you consider yourself an independent now, or what?
I consider myself a failed liberal. I believe in most of the liberal ideas, but I just believe that the Democrats have just abandoned us.
Mm-hmm. Alex, you want to respond?
Sure. I think that Lee raises a great point, which is that in order to reach out to the middle of the country and break out of the traditional coasts where liberals have been operating, they're going to have to speak to the issues of wage stagnation and economic insecurity, and they're going to have to come up with policy ideas at the state level that address this.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Lee, for the call. Richard in Madison, hi.
Hello?
Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
I don't understand how the Democratic Party missed this. I mean, the Koch brothers were exposed already in 2010 in the New Yorker by Jane Meyer. The Nation in 2011, you know, exposed them. I called Democratic headquarters or emailed them. No response.
Alex.
So I think that the caller is right, that there's been some important investigative journalism, like the work of Jane Mayer and also the work at The Nation, that's helped put some of these pieces together and raise the prominence of these sorts of activities. But it's going to take more than just realizing that they exist for the left to take action. You know, there's going to have to be funders that put money into new organizations. There's going to have to be mobilization of lawmakers, of voters, of grassroots activists across the state. So, you know, I think recognizing that there's a problem is the first step to taking action, but then there are some important secondary steps that need to be taken in order to ensure that the left can start to regain prominence in the state.
Hmm. How do all of these organizations get together? Do they have big retreats with lots of food and everybody sits around and decides what they want to take on as issues? Do the conservatives operate differently than the liberals? Do actual legislators go to events sponsored by conservative groups and liberal groups?
Yeah, so there are a couple of good points there. I think one is that, conservatives have used annual convenings quite effectively to bring together lawmakers, private sector firms, and conservative advocacy groups over time. You know, ALEC has multiple meetings every year where the lawmakers get to attend these rather nice convenings at nice hotels in appealing cities and talk about these policy ideas with companies and with conservative activists. And I think that helps to explain in part their success. You know, who doesn't want that kind of a trip, especially if you're a lawmaker who doesn't get paid all that much, quite frankly. And so liberals would do well to think about using convenings strategically like that to help solidify social networks and to attract people to their organizations. These organizations also are intertwined because they are sometimes institutionally affiliated. So, for instance, many state policy network affiliates, those are the conservative state-level think tanks, sit on task forces at ALEC and so help to come up with a model bill ideas, or they might be brought in to provide research reports on behalf of ALEC model bills. And Americans for Prosperity often organizes events and rallies in support of the model bills that ALEC is producing. So you see coordination on that level as well.
Mm-hmm. Pat is next in Richland. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good afternoon, folks. I have a question for your guest, and with these changes in law that ALEC proposes, particularly with less government openness and just a whole bunch of laws, after those laws take effect, do you have any sense as to whether they're taking us toward a country where it's more of a land of the rule of law, or kind of headed toward the direction where it's a land more of a rule of man?
So I can't speak to that specific question, but from my own research, I've tracked where states enact ALEC model bills and then what happens to their economies. And I show in my research that where states pass these measures, you're less likely to see strong unions and you're more likely to see increases in inequality, in part as a result of the reduction in union density, but in part as a result of changes to regulation and taxes, especially on the wealthy and on businesses. So I think you do see, you know, substantive changes in important economic outcomes as a result of these ALEC proposals.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about money for a little longer. You write that conservative groups have enjoyed higher levels of consistent funding than networks on the left. Where is all that money coming from, and why is it more consistent? And do liberals have access to the same kinds of funds?
So on the conservative side, you initially saw groups like ALEC and the State Policy Network being supported by center-right and conservative philanthropies, foundations associated with families such as SCAIF, Olin, and Coors. And those organizations were important because they gave general support to ALEC initially that helped get it off the ground. And then over time, ALEC replaced that foundation funding largely with support from private sector companies. So that's where most of its funding comes from, although it still gets some of its funding from these conservative foundations. On the left, center-left foundations have been much more sporadic in their support of left-wing state networks. And so you'll see some initial support, but often it tends to be very earmarked and project-specific, which makes it hard for organizations to grow. And then that support would often peter out over time as foundations focused on a different issue. Mm-hmm. And in general, these foundations, I find, were reluctant to fund advocacy at the state level, both out of a cultural perspective on the left that big change happens at the national level. I think people think about the Great Society, the New Deal. These were major initiatives, but they happened mainly from D.C. outward rather than from the state up. And I think it also stems from a historical fear of delegating power to the state. You know, you think about what happened with civil rights and other social benefits, you kind of get a race to the bottom where the stingiest states set the standards. And I think a lot of funders on the left were afraid of that happening. But I think there's a growing recognition that more attention needs to be paid to the states from these funders. And you've seen the Democracy Alliance, which is a group of progressive, wealthy folks, millionaires and some billionaires, investing money in these state networks, including the State Innovation Exchange. So it'll be important to see whether or not that pays off.
Mm-hmm. Pat, thanks so much for your call. Frankie in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Frankie.
I wanted to know how does he reconcile this information that he has against that article that appeared a short time ago in the Atlantic Monthly about the country moving to the left?
That's a great question, Patty. Thank you. Well, I had the chance to read that article, and I found some of its arguments convincing. But I think it rests fundamentally on this perspective that liberals will be okay if we just sit tight and wait for these demographic changes to happen.
Oh, dear. Something happened to our phone. Hello? Oh, that's very strange sound. We're going to have to try and get you back. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened to the phone. Sounded perfectly normal until a couple minutes ago. Alexander Hertel Fernandez is our guest this hour. He's a doctoral candidate in government and social policy at Harvard University, and we're looking at a very interesting study that he did looking at conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity and ALEC and why it is that they are so successful in getting more money and also in enacting more legislation in states that are more conservative-leaning. Why is it that they're more successful than liberal groups? We also are talking about some of those liberal groups, what they are and how they maybe could, if they want to be as effective as the conservative groups, need to follow some of their playbook. On the left, he says, liberal activists, academics, and D.C. policy organizations have used intermittent and modest funding from foundations and labor unions to build left-leaning policy networks. The National Conference on Alternative State and Local Policies, founded in 1975, later the Center for Policy Alternatives, had a lot of growth in the 90s before it diminished. There are some. In 2014, progressive philanthropists founded State Innovation Exchange, which aspires to become a competitor to ALEC. But the question remains why the right has been more successful than the left. And also lots of questions about the very nature of these groups and how incredibly involved they are in lots of important policies on the state level. So, Frankie, I'm sorry, do you want to continue, Frankie, with... Well, yeah, you were in the middle, actually, of saying, Alex, that you have read that article.
Yes, and so thanks for raising that point. I found many of its arguments compelling. So the general gist of it is pointing to polling data that shows that on a range of issues, Americans actually hold quite liberal attitudes, wanting new forms of government intervention to ensure economic security and growth. And I find that compelling, but it's a question of who ultimately turns out to vote in elections. That's one issue, and it turns out that when it comes to these state legislative elections, the sort of people that turn out aren't the sort of people who prefer more government intervention. They tend to be older and whiter and less likely to be immigrants, and as a result, that's reflected in the sort of people that are elected. You saw that in 2010 and again in 2014. And of course, another issue is who ultimately shapes policy. So do you have organized interest groups that represent young people, minorities, and the sort of people that would prefer more government intervention to ensure economic security? And across the states, you just don't have that. You have organized interest groups on the right and representing business that are pushing a very different agenda.
Thank you so much for your call. Tim writes on Facebook, I don't think there really are liberal equivalents to ALEC in terms of getting bills passed. Are there, Alex?
Well, there have been over the years. You know, I think just before I rejoined the call, you had been mentioning the National Conference on Alternative State and Local Policy that in many ways was trying to do similar work as ALEC, convene state lawmakers together, share ideas for public policy, get those ideas passed into law. And its successor, the Center for Policy Alternatives, was trying to do similar work as well. So you've seen efforts over time to counter ALEC.
We go next to Stan in Monona. Hi, Stan.
Hi. Well, I think we can agree there are groups on both sides. Definitely ALEC and the Republican groups are more powerful, but that's just terrible.
Alex.
Well, so certainly you can disagree with the content that these groups are producing, but I think the fact remains that if you look at the sort of bills that are getting passed across the country right now, conservatives and the right have an edge, you know, when it comes to voter restrictions, limiting who can turn out to vote, limits on the expansion of Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act, and limits on the rights of public sector workers to collectively bargain and organize across all of those very important areas. The agendas of ALEC, the State Policy Network, and Americans for Prosperity are winning out over the left.
Mm-hmm. Doug from Randolph, I don't know if you have information on this, but maybe you do, Alex, asks, is there any other country that allows this much money into politics to buy the system?
You know, so we're an outlier in terms of our campaign finance system, in terms of the length of our elections and the amount of money that gets spent. But in many ways, there are interest groups in other countries. They just look a lot different. And I think what's unique about the United States is that we have this highly decentralized federal system where the states have significant autonomy, and you can have interest groups that operate across the states in that way. So that's in part what makes us unique.
Mm-hmm. Lori is next in Viroqua. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Would you talk about the think tank involvement in social welfare policy? It seems like 20 years ago, ALEC and maybe the Bradley Foundation and the SCAFE Foundation were involved, very much involved in eliminating AFDC and turning it over to the states, in this case Wisconsin, and turning it, you know, a cash base to the workfare type programs. And they haven't been held accountable for it. So in Milwaukee, you know, people are poor. Black people basically are poorer than they ever have been, and yet the discussion is about how, you know, the teachers and all these other institutions where it's been, you know, it seems to me it's a pretty direct result of the changes in the welfare policy and the way assistance is provided to people. So would you be able to comment about that?
Yeah, so thanks for your comment, and I think you make the good observation that, you know, conservative organizations, foundations made welfare reform, but also criminal justice reform, educational reform, a big priority in the 70s and 80s. And you saw many states, including Wisconsin, pass a lot of those provisions to tighten eligibility and benefits for welfare programs, to make criminal justice sentencing more punitive through measures like three strikes laws and other restrictions, and to introduce forms of school choice, charter initiatives across the country. And I think that just goes to show you that when you have these sorts of networks that are operating across the states, when you make something a key priority, you can really have a big effect. You can pass the same bill, the same ideas across many states at once.
Mm-hmm. And how do you determine what kind of discussion takes place to decide what the key priorities are, Alex?
At the legislative level or within these interest groups?
Within these groups.
That's a tricky subject, and it's actually one that ALEC has had to deal with over time. So when it first got started, it tended to be mainly movement conservatives who were participating, who cared a lot about things like welfare reform, criminal justice reform, you know, gay marriage, the Equal Rights Amendment. And because they were focused on these highly controversial conservative priorities, they had a hard time attracting a lot of businesses. And it was only when they gave movement conservatives a slightly smaller role in setting the agenda that they were able to attract more businesses by making themselves more business friendly and saying to firms, you can come here and promote your model bill ideas about these narrow technical issues on regulation or tax policy. That helped change their agenda. But I think you saw a shift back towards a more ideologically conservative focus within ALEC in the 2000s with the restrictions on voter ID requirements and on gun rights, public safety. And I think that's why ALEC rose to prominence again in the mid-2000s.
Thanks, Laurie. Let's go to Claire in Madison. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. ALEC has a right to exist, of course, and that's fine. But what really, really disturbs me, Kathleen, and your guest last hour mentioned this, there are actually more Democrats than Republicans in the country, and I'm sure ALEC is aware of that. And what disturbs me is the way they are willing to cheat, I would call it, to get what they want, such as gerrymandering, trying to change voter rights so that people can't vote or making it very difficult to vote. And at least in this state, trying to pass very unpopular laws in the middle of the night. And I think it's extremely disturbing.
Alex.
I think there are two important observations there. One is, of course, the observation that ALEC, like any other interest group, you know, has the right to petition government, and it may have information that's useful to lawmakers, services that are important to lawmakers. So I think that's an important point to recognize. The second thing to recognize that I think the caller did a nice job of highlighting is the idea that conservatives have really played for the rules. You know, when you change who can vote, when you change what sorts of organizations have the right to organize and exist, for instance, like unions, you have the power to change the political landscape in important ways, and that's something liberals need to catch up on when it comes to conservative victories across the state.
Mm. They have been incredibly effective in taking on unions, haven't they, in such a substantial way, and actually fairly recently.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a combination of the Republican control of state legislatures and governorships combined with the recognition on the right that unions are a big funder of Democratic
yes.
causes, of progressive lobbying. So by removing unions from the equation, you're not only achieving a free market outcome, which you might, if you're on the right, you might think that that's, you know, an ideologically good thing, but you're also taking away a key political opponent and making it easier for your side to pass policy going forward.
Mm-hmm. Some would say voting restrictions. ALEC has been behind that?
Yes, historically. It's now backed away from some of these measures, but it has historically promoted measures that would make it more challenging to vote. Measures, for instance, like requiring IDs or changes to when voting can occur.
Mm-hmm. And what about liberal policies that have been successful, Alex?
So in recent years, and I think it's important to point out, liberals haven't had a great deal of success at the state level, but there have been important innovations across cities. You know, that's one area
yes.
where liberals have been having some success. And I'd point to paid sick leave as an important success across a range of cities in the United States. Progressive groups operating together in networks have managed to pass paid sick leave measures. As you and your callers know, the United States is one of the few countries in the world that does not give paid sick leave, medical leave to its workers. But some cities are taking action on that. The minimum wage is another area, too,
mm-hmm.
where a lot of cities have taken action, even some states as well. So those are two important victories on the left. But I think it's easier for liberals to organize at the city level, because that's often where a lot of liberals' base supporters are located, young people, minorities, people who overwhelmingly hold progressive values and perspectives are concentrated in these cities, which makes it easier for them to pass these measures.
More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Alex Hertel Fernandez. He's a doctoral candidate in government and social policy at Harvard University, studying the political economy of the U.S., and he has looked at conservative groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council, Americans for Prosperity, are much better than their liberal counterparts in leveraging policy and in passing laws. And there have been many such laws passed in conservative states, looking at unions, lessening the power of unions, certainly voting rights, guns, another issue where they have been very successful. Why is it that there are less successful groups, not as well funded, on the liberal side of the political spectrum? Our phone number, and we have lines open, they've been really crowded. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. So we'll return to you and the conversation. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls. We have about 10 minutes to go. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the next caller is Carolyn in Madison. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I know that Alex's been interested in a lot of corporate control, or not public control, of a lot of stuff. And I understand that more control over public lands has been on their agenda, and that these what's happening in Oregon right now is sort of these guys are sort of like foot soldiers for that effort, in a sense. That's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you, Carolyn. Alex.
Yeah, so if you go back through Alex's archives, you can see that this has been a priority for quite some time. They're supporters of the so-called Sagebrush Rebellion that happened a few decades ago, when there were efforts to reclaim public land for private use out in the West. And so this has been something that's been on their radar for a while. But I think it's a nice example of a priority that Alec has pursued that simultaneously achieves sort of a free market perspective, but then also benefits the sort of private sector interests that are associated with Alec, the sort of companies that are paying membership dues and participating in its task forces.
Hmm. Dan in Madison, hi.
Yes. How hard is it going to be in the future to wage populist grassroots movements, ground up, you know, from the bottom, to make changes in our political system and public policy, if everything is going to be dictated by these very powerful groups that get money from private industry, private parties, wealthy individuals, and you know, on and on. You had one caller and said, "I'm not going to vote. You know, I give up." You know,
mm-hmm.
And how much of that cynicism and the fact that it's accomplishing a lot of things—not only is it passing laws, but it's also making people feel totally demoralized and powerless.
Interesting question. Thank you. Thanks so much for the call, Dan.
So throughout history, grassroots movements have been essential for pushing back against the concentration of economic wealth and corporate power. You know, you look at the Gilded Era or the New Deal, there were important grassroots efforts and mobilization that happened then. And I think we're living through a time where we're still seeing grassroots mobilization. Black Lives Matter shows that young people can be mobilized to these sorts of causes. Occupy Wall Street did an important job of raising economic inequality as an issue in the public imagination. Even the Tea Party is a great example of grassroots mobilization on the other side of the equation. So I think grassroots mobilization still can happen, but I think, you know, you need organization and you need a concrete set of policy proposals. And this is probably a topic for another day, but I think one reason why Occupy Wall Street was less successful than, say, the Tea Party is that the Tea Party had very specific policy demands and they cared about elections. Yeah. As your caller said, some people just throw up their hands and give up on the whole electoral or legislative process. But if you're going to be a grassroots movement, you need to channel that energy into electing people, holding them accountable, making sure that they have the fear of being primaried if they vote against your constituency.
Dave in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I could be dead wrong, but I thought that the Koch brothers or father, I thought he was the guy who started the John Bircher Society.
So the father of the Kochs had been involved with the Birch Society. He was a key leader. For more details on that, the details of that are a bit fuzzy on my mind, but there's a terrific biography of that family by an author named Schulman called Sons of Wichita that I've relied on heavily. So I think you could find the answer there.
Hmm.
Well, cool. Thank you.
Okay. Might be a good talk show, too. Sons of Wichita. Stephen in Dorchester, Iowa. Hi.
Yes, fascinating topic. I just wanted to respond to the gentleman that called about not knowing whether he was going to be able to vote this time because he thought the party, his party had kind of deserted him. But I was wanting to say that not voting kind of plays into the party that you really don't want to support. And if you put the other party in office, you have, like, no chance. If you put the party, one other party in, at least you may have a chance of having an influence. And so a lot of times I vote Democratic mainly because I'm voting anti-Republican. Sometimes, too, I think the Democrats don't always fill the bill, but I know with the Republicans in office, at least the Democrats are not working. They may not, if they're not working for me, they're at least not working against me, in which I feel like the Republican Party always is. So I would urge everybody not to not vote. You have no say if you don't vote.
Was there a time, Stephen, when you were really excited about voting?
I'm excited about voting all the time to keep Republicans out of office.
Okay.
I mean, I'd vote for any party that kept the Republican out of office because I just, everything I believe in, they're against, and everything I'm against, they're for. So, it's pretty easy call for me, even though I don't, I feel like sometimes the Democrats don't do a good enough job, but at least if the Democrat in office, I think I've got a chance, with Republicans in office, I know that it's going the wrong direction.
Thank you, Stephen, very much for the call. You can understand, though, how people are disheartened when you look at issues like gerrymandering, when you look at the control and the influence that these organizations have, be they on the right where they have more influence or on the left. You can understand why people are upset, can't you, with the political system, thinking, I don't have any influence at all.
Absolutely, and I think that couples with the sort of economic insecurity that many Americans have felt. We're in the middle of a economic recovery and employment is growing at a great pace, but still many Americans for the past decade or so haven't seen good wage gains, and they may have seen their health insurance cut. They've seen certainly the cost of healthcare and education. You're paying for college going up as well. And so it's easy to feel very pressured and feel as if your politicians aren't responding to you. And in many cases they are not.
Yeah. Thank you, Stephen, so much for your call. Al in Green Bay, hi.
Hi, how do you do?
Hi, Al.
I've got a question for your guest, actually two of them. First, an informed and engaged electorate is crucial for democracy. I read somewhere that a significant percentage of the public can't even pass a high school civics test. How would you recommend improving that? Number two, I asked a congressman to send me a list of the bills he has to vote on. He said, I can't do that. He said it often changes from Thursday to Tuesday when he comes back to the Capitol. I'd like you to address that as well.
Thank you, Al. I love the first
Thanks
question.
So
How
so
do we become
question.
More informed and engaged? How would you do that, Alex?
It's a tall order, and I don't know if I have all the answers, but certainly more civic participation would be beneficial for our democracy. But we can't just rely on voters. You need organizations, because as much as I commend the caller for trying to keep personally keep his lawmaker accountable on the sort of bills that that lawmaker is voting on, we can't expect all citizens to do that. You know, they might not have the knowledge or even the time to do that. That's why you need organizations in place to keep politicians accountable. And organizations can be the ones that threaten lawmakers if they vote against a particular measure, or support them if they end up supporting a particular bill that the organization supports.
And thank you so much, Al, for your call. That's all the time we have. Alex, thank you very much. All the best with all of your continuing studies. It's good to be looking at these groups. There isn't enough awareness, I don't think, about them.
Yes, I've been having a lot of fun doing this research. Thanks so much for having me on, and for the callers as well, for a stimulating discussion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Our guest, Alexander Hertel Fernandez, doctoral candidate in government and social policy at Harvard, where he studies the political economy of the U.S., looking at organized interests, business, public policy. His research has been published in a number of reviews, and his work has also appeared on MSNBC, NPR, Salon, Talking Points Memo, The Washington Post, and other places. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. A reminder, tomorrow it should be a very interesting show, a physician's memoir, Inside Syria, My Life as a Child, a Student, and a Doctor in an Era of War. So our guest will be joining us to talk about that tomorrow during this particular time period. Thanks very much for participating today and for listening on the Ideas Network.